Welcome to The Buzz. I'm Christopher Conover. This week, forecasting the economy, both nationally and locally. Arizona's economy has slowed, but continues to avoid recession. The state's unemployment rate remains around 3.5%, a number last seen in 2007. That pairs with a workforce that's never been larger. The number of Arizonans who have or want a job is now more than 3.6 million. And those workers are earning more money, with an average pay of almost $58,000 a year. All of those statistics continue to trend towards the positive. But one indicator that's been of concern lately, the inflation rate, while remaining concerningly high, is trending down. The measure of price hikes on common goods peaked for the state's largest metro area at 13% last August. It's dropped every quarter since and is now around 7.5%. With that in mind, we checked in with Dr. George Hammond. He's the director of the Economic and Business Research Center at the University of Arizona Eller College of Management. When we talked with Dr. Hammond in December, he predicted that Arizona's economy would slow but avoid recession. I started this conversation by asking him why he thinks that prediction came true, while also offering him a chance for some self-congratulation.
Well, part of the reason that the Tucson economy is still adding jobs is that the national economy has been more resilient than expected. It's just done better than pretty much anybody thought it would do through the first half of 2023, and the U.S. economy now looks set to be pretty resilient through the remainder of 2023. Now the danger period is going to be in 2024, but even so, Tucson, I think, is going to continue to be resilient. Even if the national economy falls into a modest downturn, I think Tucson will come through that in better shape. We may see significantly slow job growth if the national economy falls into recession. But, Tucson is well positioned to continue to grow, especially if the national economy continues to grow.
What makes Tucson so well positioned?
Well, part of it is that we are still attracting large numbers of migrants from other states. That's really helped. That's going to slow. But overall, we're still going to be a fairly attractive destination, particularly for people who are priced out of the housing markets in California's major metropolitan areas, and particularly Southern California. In LA, in the fourth quarter of last year, only 2.2% of homes were affordable to a family making the median income, compared to 35% here in Tucson.
You mentioned migrants in the sense of people coming here from other states. New jobs report out this morning talked about immigration, and it was a strong jobs report, and said stabilization of immigration has actually helped with jobs here. And I guess being close to the border, that really affects us too.
It may be part of the picture for Arizona. We don't have the data to say for sure, but it's very good news that migration, international migration to the U.S. is up. That will help us with labor supply, which is something that held back job growth in 2021 and 2022.
So looking forward to that possible slowdown in 2024, granted we're a long way out still, but what are some of the bumps you see, especially for Southern Arizona, as we come into that possible slowdown in 24?
Well, one of the major risks for Arizona and Southern Arizona is the risk of a national downturn. Even though the national economy has been pretty resilient in the face of major interest rate increases and major bank failures so far, those events have weakened U.S. economic growth. They're designed to weaken U.S. economic growth to pull down inflation. That's working. But, it's a tough needle to thread for the Federal Reserve to slow the U.S. economy without driving it into recession. So that's a risk. The U.S. economy falls into recession, that will pull the rug out from under Tucson's growth. Doesn't mean we'll fall into a recession, but it means we will slow down.
You mentioned inflation, and a lot of people are talking about it, price of eggs are up, but the price of gas is certainly up, though it's dropped down a little. Do you see any relief from that coming? The Fed, as you said, has been trying to change some things, but prices are still up.
Absolutely. We are seeing significant progress in terms of inflation coming down. The metric that we have is for the Phoenix metro area. Inflation in Phoenix last year peaked at 13% over the year. It's now down to 7.4%. So that's significant improvement, but we've got a long way to go. The 7.4% is a lot more than the national average at 4.9%. But we're making progress, and we're going to continue to make progress as we go through 2023 and into 2024. And we will eventually see inflation back to, you know, the Fed's target, somewhere around 2%.
You mentioned housing earlier, also pointing out that in California, 2% of families can afford a house who are making the median income, more like 35% here. That's still a sore point for a lot of people, though. Housing went up. Is our 35% sustainable?
Well, that is something we may have to live with for a while, and that will have knock-on effects on construction activity and migration to Tucson. You know, Tucson has seen a huge drop in housing affordability, just as the most areas of the nation have. You know, Tucson's housing affordability before the pandemic was around 70%. We're down to 35%. So, you know, we've experienced the same huge declines that pretty much everybody has. And that will have impacts on the ability of households to afford a house. If they can actually get into a house, they may be house poor, so they're devoting so much of their income that their housing costs burdened, and that will restrict their spending on other items, non-housing items. And that means impacts on realtors. It means impacts on future construction. It means impacts on migration. People, we're already hearing stories about people who are unwilling to move because they don't want to give up their 3% mortgage for, you know, a 6 or 7% mortgage because it's such a big difference to their overall standard of living.
Arizona's seen some pretty good job growth, well, especially since the pandemic losses, but there are questions about, are people just out of the job market? So maybe the job growth isn't quite what the statistics say. What's your thought on that? What's the reality of job growth here?
I think immigration has helped with labor supply, but it's still really tight. Unemployment rates are very low, you know, lowest in 25 years for the U.S., and lowest since 1976 for Arizona. Tucson's very low, very tight labor market. And what's really driving that now is the fact that we had a large number of retirements during the pandemic. Those people are out of the labor market. The vast majority are not coming back. And that means that, you know, labor markets are going to be tight, you know, tighter than they would have been otherwise going forward. This was a demographic transition we knew was going to happen. Without the pandemic, it would have happened more gradually. The pandemic caused a lot of it to happen all at once. And that's just where we're at.
Big financial news, I guess, economics news out of Phoenix is Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Company going in up there. How does a big economic announcement like that up north, or to our north at least, affect the state economy as a whole?
Those are big announcements. Those are significant numbers of jobs in the manufacturing sector. There will be additional locations of supplier and supporting industries. So it's going to have a significant impact on jobs, income, and output for the state as a whole. You know, Tucson's participating a little bit. We have a major battery factory coming that will contribute to Tucson's manufacturing job growth, which is, you know, pretty solid during the pandemic. We're up about 1,000 jobs from where we were in February 2020. So that will be good for Tucson as well. So the, you know, the manufacturing sector will be you know, a solid contributor to the state economy going forward.
As you and I are speaking, just hours ago, the U.S. Senate passed the debt ceiling bill. The president is expected to sign it any time now. We dodged the default bullet. But for Tucson, Southern Arizona, we have a lot of federal spending here between Davis-Monthan, Fort Huachuca, the Border Patrol, Raytheon missiles. If a default ever happened, would we feel the pinch harder than maybe other areas of the state or the region?
We'd have to take a look at that to estimate the size, but I suspect we would feel a bigger hit than most other places because federal government activity is such a big part of the local economy. I think the impact would have to be, concentrated a bit on defense. We also have a significant portion of our population that's receiving Medicare and Social Security benefits. So if those were interrupted, there would be an economic impact there. A lot depends on the specifics of a debt default if it happened and, how long it lasted and how the Treasury chose to deal with that.
All right. Well, thanks for spending some time with us.
Sure. My pleasure.
That was George Hammond, director of the Economic and Business Research Center at the University of Arizona's Eller College of Management. You're listening to The Buzz. I'm Christopher Conover. We're checking in on economic conditions from local to national levels this week. We shift our attention to national issues that have a notable effect on Arizona. For this, we speak with economist Dr. Anthony Chan, whose resume includes work at the Federal Reserve Bank, Barclays, and most recently the chief economist at J.P. Morgan Chase, a job he retired from a few years ago. Chan continues to stay active in economics and now writes a Substack newsletter called The People's Economist. I started our conversation by asking him about a recent item in that newsletter, an analysis of how changes to federal banking insurance rules could affect people in places like Arizona.
The answer to your question is that these bank deposit insurance situation is sort of like an externality. That if you have it, it really protects everybody. And if you don't have it, there are people that are vulnerable. You're going to see some states and some area and jurisdictions that don't have a problem. But in reality, when you have a banking crisis and it causes banks all over the United States and credit conditions to tighten, eventually it hits every community because interest rates reflect that. And the interest rates are paid by every part of the United States. Now, what are the changes? Those are being proposed by the FDIC, and they open it up to a comment period of 60 days, and we'll see. They get comments from depositors, they get comments from the banks, small, medium size, and large, and then they make a decision. But it's very clear that right now there was some concern that maybe some depositors were not protected enough, especially small businesses that may have payroll situation where it would be much larger than $250,000. So one idea is just to increase it above the $250,000 for business individuals. Other ideas, of course, are to increase it a little higher even for regular people because that prevents them from having to go around and try to split their deposits among many different banks. The problem with this situation is that you can't just increase insurance willy-nilly. Somebody has to pay for those premiums. And the question is, who should pay for them? Should it be the smaller banks that had the problems, but they're the most vulnerable? Should it be the larger banks? They'll say, well, we didn't have a problem. Why should we pay? Or should everybody pay for it? So it is a bit controversial, and we will see how that pans out. But I think it's pretty clear that some sort of innovation is necessary given the problems that we saw, even though they were geographically concentrated both on the West Coast and in other parts, but mostly on the West Coast. So we do need some new regulation or some fresh look at how to handle deposit insurance.
To stay with your newsletter, your Substack newsletter, you also wrote about the issue of hunger in the U.S. How is hunger an economic issue? People might not tie those two together all the time.
Well, what you tend to see, and I'm probably the most nonpartisan economist out there, so I don't have an agenda. And every time I write an article, I give both sides and I let people decide. So no axe to grind. But one of the things that you are seeing now is that you're seeing a bigger disparity in economic growth. So you're seeing more people using food banks, even though the economy is not in a recession. And so these are things to consider as to how do we deal with those things. Now, we can easily say, oh, we should just raise taxes on those people that are well off. But those people create jobs for the people that are not so well off. So you got to balance it out there. But it is interesting to see that even though we have prosperity, we have not had a recession, we are seeing some real pain at lower ends of the spectrum. And then you have other individuals that say, oh, no, people are just wanting to be freeloaders. They want to get food stamps and things like that. But the average benefit per meal of somebody receiving food stamps, it's $1.87 per meal across the United States. I know that it's really challenging to find a place where you can actually buy dinner for $1.87 or lunch or even breakfast. So I don't think those people are necessarily freeloaders. We just got a new deficit agreement where they're going to impose some work restrictions for some individuals and for homeless and veterans, they're not. But I think the bottom line, I think it's important to shine a light, is to say that even though people that need these benefits are getting them, I don't think that they're living high on the hog with $1.87 per meal. And that's just something to think about when we look at the people that need our help.
Inflation, big topic all over the country. Phoenix, just up the road from us at one point, had the highest inflation at 13% in the country. Is there a magic bullet that would solve all of our inflationary woes? And maybe if you had it, you wouldn't be sitting here. You'd be out pushing that idea out. But, or is the problem more multifaceted than just a simple silver bullet to fix it?
No, I think the problem is multifaceted. But if you want a silver bullet, you can solve the inflation problem very quickly, and that is crash the economy and cause massive unemployment and massive economic slowdown. But the question is, what are those side benefits, negative side side effects? So I think that the Federal Reserve is trying to really juggle both of those things by saying we're going to slow the economy down, because after all, they cannot increase supply of anything. There was a shortage of food, a shortage of energy at one point. And in fact, Ben Bernanke and Blanchard, who used to work for one of the top world organizations, recently wrote a paper about 2 weeks ago, fascinating paper, where they actually attribute inflation to two factors. One, the Russian-Ukraine war, because that obviously created shortages, supply chain disruptions, food price increases, and things like that. But now we know the supply chain disruptions are easing, not as much of a problem. And now they say that it's switching over to wages, that somehow wages are to blame. Now, I actually agree. As a former Federal Reserve economist, I always have a lot of respect for stuff that's done at the Federal Reserve. So I do agree with Bernanke and his colleague, Blanchard, in the paper, talking about the reasons why we had inflation in 2021 and 2022. But now in 2023, when they start to shift the focus onto wages, I have a little bit of a problem with that, because, in fact, we just got the employment report, and the latest employment report shows that for 24 consecutive months, guess what? Average hourly earnings or wages are rising slower than inflation. So you can't really say there's a one-to-one mapping. And I've been saying this for quite some time. But fascinating, just this week, another fascinating academic study was put out by the San Francisco Federal Reserve that showed, guess what? That when you look at changes in wages and you try to map them into changes in inflation, the core personal consumption deflator specifically that the Federal Reserve monitors, they can only find a fraction of the increase in wages spilling over into inflation out there. And then they do some fancy econometric work, which I remember when I worked at the Fed and when I was a university professor that I also used to do. And guess what? Even when they do the fancy econometric work and they look at surprises in wages, they only find that less than 30% of the increase in wages translates into higher inflation. So I know the big question is, then where does the other 70% go? The study finds that changes in wages usually get absorbed in profit margin changes or sometimes innovation. And so you do a lot of innovation, use less labor, and you get around it. Now, I know a lot of people are going to be a little cynical about that, but if when is the last time that you went into a McDonald's or a Burger King or a Wendy's and tried to order food from somebody? Wages have gone up. Now they have kiosks, machines where you actually order. And right now, even the drive-thru, they're working on artificial intelligence and machine learning techniques, so you don't even order through a person in the drive-thru, that somebody's actually going to be out there using these machines. So again, this study makes a lot of sense, because anytime I read an academic study, and I was an academic for many years, I'm always cynical. But when I see that the academic results translate into real-world activity, I pay attention, and so I do agree that higher wages, yes, they influence inflation, but it's only a fraction. So we can't get all that nervous. And in the latest employment report, guess what? Wages are rising 4.3% year over year. The consumer price index rising 4.9%. So wages are actually lagging inflation. And consumers, of course, are falling behind.
When we talk about wages, of course, that works into and inflation. Works into something that's important here in Southern Arizona, especially housing. We're really feeling the increase in housing prices. George Hammond mentioned right before you came in that 35% of the folks who live in our area and make the median income could afford a house at this point. Better than California, but down from 70%. So how do places like Southern Arizona that have rising home prices get to a better place with interest rates going up also?
Well, it's a real challenge, because what you have essentially is a shortage of housing. You see that certainly in existing home sales, where the normal inventory should be around 6 months, and it's below 2 months. So you can't see prices really de-escalating on a national basis. Now, some hot markets are seeing a little de-escalation in prices, but in general, prices are still holding out quite well. And I know that here in Arizona, in Tucson, you're still seeing some bidding wars. And so these bidding wars are telling me that these shortages of housing, and by the way, even in the new home sales area, you got permit restrictions and those things delay things. All that is joining and aligning with each other to continue to restrict supply. And so even though affordability is bad, and even though interest rates are rising and higher, which makes affordability even worse, these price pressures are continuing. So what we need to see is more output out there. And right now, when you look at existing home sales, the biggest thing, and I recently spoke at a housing conference, the biggest problem is that when somebody has a mortgage that's 3% or lower, why should they sell and move somewhere else, even to a better house that they like, and get a mortgage rate that's closer to 7%? They're simply locked up, and they're not releasing that inventory, which continue to exacerbate the situation. So it is a problem. The good news is that as inflation continues to come down, and by the way, the peak inflation rate for the consumer price index, 9.1%, it's now, as I said earlier, 4.9% and heading lower. Even the average hourly earnings number from the latest employment report, the lowest number on a year-over-year basis since 2021, in the early part of 2021. So inflation is moving in the right direction. As that process continues, we will see that interest rates will eventually gravitate lower, and these problems will, in some sense, not be fully corrected, but that we will be moving in the right direction.
Let's talk about some almost breaking news. A few hours ago, the Senate passed the bill that keeps the U.S. from defaulting. A couple of weeks ago, you shared your thoughts on the debt ceiling and default in the form of poetry. Would you care to, in verse, give us your thoughts on what has now happened and maybe what these continuing debates that we have every few years on the debt ceiling do overall?
Well, thank you for pointing that out. That was a poem. Again, that just epitomizes how nonpartisan I am, since I did not attribute the blame to any political party and said both of them could share the blame. People should look under my LinkedIn page and they'll see that poem that I wrote, which is interesting. And it really tells you that there was a lot of dysfunction between between both political parties because they let it get to this point. But let me extrapolate from that poem, which I think epitomizes the problems that both political parties were facing, to say that as I looked at the agreement and I read the 99-page agreement, because what else can you do on a Saturday night but read the 99 congressional legislation agreement, what I found was that it's going to reduce economic growth this year in 2023 by my estimates about 0.3%, and next year by about 0.5%. These are all factors that are going to hold back economic growth. And by the way, in another research report that I wrote on Substack, I talked about the fact that economic growth has done so well so far. This is one of my latest articles, simply because we had excess savings. In fact, in a recent academic study, they found that as much as $2.1 trillion of excess savings early in the recession or early during the pandemic occurred. That's why consumers kept spending. Now it's down to $500 billion, but still more than what we would see based on the fundamentals and according to the trends. So that's why we haven't seen a recession so far. But that money will run out by the end of the year. And guess what? This agreement, and I make no judgments as to whether it's good or bad, because that's what it means to be nonpartisan, will subtract economic growth. And then, by the way, the student loans, if that gets resolved, that will also subtract from economic growth because more money will come out. I'll leave it to your listeners to decide whether those are good things or bad things. I simply count the beans, and the beans suggest slower economic growth. That is something that we're going to have to deal with.
All right. Well, thank you for sitting down with us.
My pleasure.
That was economist Anthony Chan. And that's The Buzz for this week. Tune in next week as we check in on the OSIRIS-REx space mission and see what scientists hope to learn when it returns to Earth this fall. You can find all our episodes online at azpm.org and subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcast. Just search for The Buzz Arizona. We're also on the NPR One app. Zach Ziegler is our producer with production help from Desiree Tucker. Our music is by Enter the Haggis. I'm Christopher Conover. Thanks for listening.
Arizona Public Media's original programming is made possible in part by the Community Service Grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.